This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. John Kerry may not have clinched the Democratic nomination for president in yesterday's primaries and caucuses, but his victories in five of the seven races certainly completed his rehabilitation from an also-ran to a front-runner. John Edwards and Wesley Clark also won last night. Edwards in South Carolina, Clark in a tight race in Oklahoma, where Edwards came in second. Joe Lieberman dropped out of the race altogether. Howard Dean vowed to fight on despite a dismal showing. So did Al Sharpton, who placed third in South Carolina. Dennis Kucinich barely registered with voters. All the candidates now have their eyes on the future, with contests in delegate-heavy states now up for grabs. Later in the program, we'll be leafing through the Democratic candidates' campaign-driven books, but right now, the race. Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Both our guests are here with me in Studio 3A. Stuart Rothenberg is a political analyst. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
And he's also the editor of the Rothenberg Political Report. Also with me today, Ken Rudin. He's NPR's political editor, and he writes the NPR online column Political Junkie. Good to have you here.
Hi, Lynn.
Are these outcomes pretty much what you expected, first of all, Ken?
It is. John Kerry, as you say, is the front runner. He's done nothing to damage his case. Winning 5 out of 7 is pretty remarkable. The question is, who stands up to John Kerry? Who is the alternative? Once upon a time, we were talking about who is the Undine. That's no longer the case. We want to know who's going to stand up to John Kerry, if anybody.
And how much of a threat is Edwards to John Kerry at this point?
Well, I think that Edwards established his credibility as an alternative by winning South Carolina and winning it handily. He performed well in Oklahoma, decently in Missouri. But frankly, Lynn, the way this race is playing out, both Clark and Edwards are looking to cherry-pick states still at the moment to stop John Kerry, while Kerry is running a national campaign. So I think that both Edwards and Clark still have a way to go before they really constitute even a credible roadblock to the Kerry bandwagon.
And of course, the exit polling says that what continues to be the most important factor, it seems, with Democratic voters is beating George Bush, and that's where Kerry has the edge.
This was remarkable. We saw this in the caucuses in Iowa. We were talking to them as they were coming in, and they were not talking about the vote in the war in Iraq. They were not talking about the Bush tax cuts. They were talking about who could beat the president in November, and Kerry got the highest marks on that, not only Iowa and New Hampshire, but yesterday in the seven states as well.
That just seems to be the calculation that all the Democratic voters are making right now. What about Howard Dean? What's happening to the Dean campaign?
Well, this is Howard Dean campaign is kind of like a black hole. It has imploded, it seems to me. It's really amazing how quickly this has happened and how utterly completely it has happened. This was a guy who just 6 weeks ago was the front runner. Many of us thought he was nearly certain to be the nominee. I think the fact that he bypassed the seven states on Tuesday is significant. It's significant first in that they actually made a wise tactical decision, but that's the problem. The problem is that they couldn't win those states, and in many of them they would have been embarrassed, and indeed they were embarrassed. They don't have to have the resources. They're trying to husband them for later contests, whether it's Washington, Michigan, or Wisconsin. This is a campaign in disarray, without money, with new leadership, with a candidate who still has some passion, but whose message, frankly, Lynn, has been co-opted by the other candidates. Right now, if you listen to John Edwards or John Kerry, you close your eyes, their message sounds like a combination of Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean. That kind of leaves Howard Dean out in the cold.
Is this kind of a collapse, a swift collapse, as you just said, Ken? Is it unprecedented?
Well, his rise was also unprecedented because, again, the former governor of a small state, I'm not sure if he was actually the front runner only because I guess the media decided he was the front runner, even though polls showed it and he got the most, had the most money. But somehow voters in their infinite wisdom take a look at the candidates and see what they like and what they don't like. And they clearly, at least we saw in Iowa, New Hampshire, they did not particularly like Howard Dean. What's interesting to me, though, that he, as Stu says, he is focusing on states down the line. Wisconsin seems to be his make-or-break state on February 17th, which is pretty remarkable. That's the 16th state. In other words, he would be going over 16 before he wins. talking about unprecedented, that has never happened before in the history of presidential politics, to lose 15 straight states and then hope to win a state and then go on and win the nomination.
And just as winning gives a candidate some momentum, there's got to be an opposite effect from continuing to lose.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are some significant endorsers who are now reevaluating to see whether they want to stay with Howard Dean, whether they want to switch to somebody else. You're right. Winning begets winning, and losing, unfortunately, begets losing.
Now, I think we mentioned already Clark won in Oklahoma, but it was tight. It was a really tight race. How viable is his candidacy?
Well, he had to win somewhere. I mean, look. I don't want to. We shouldn't decide who's viable and who's not. I mean, obviously, if the candidates keep getting the money and keep getting support in the states,
that's true. Because everybody decided Kerry wasn't viable a few weeks back.
That's
right.
He was dead. He was dead in the water.
That's right.
30
that's
points
right.
back in New Hampshire. But anyway, Clark had to win something. The point is, though, Clark did focus heavily on Arizona and Whale and did not do well there. He did do well in Oklahoma, but again, there are big contests coming up this Saturday in Washington State and Michigan. But both Clark and Edwards are basically bypassing those caucuses and heading into next Tuesday's contest in Tennessee and Virginia. So, again, John Kerry makes the point that he's running a national campaign. He's running in every state. And as Stu said also, that both Edwards and Clark are cherry-picking. You don't win the nomination that way.
I think Clark has a couple of problems. First of all, if you look at the states where he did well, he won Oklahoma narrowly. He did pretty well in Arizona, New Mexico, and North Dakota. He's not doing well in the more rabid, big population Democratic states. Instead, he's competing with John Edwards. So in the near term, he and Edwards are going to compete for the same kind of states, whether it's Virginia or Tennessee, while John Kerry seems to have broader appeal. And second of all, Clark has spent some money. Now he's had a number of contests. Not bad showings, but he hasn't demonstrated that he's really catching fire. Remember, he's an outsider. He's the kind of candidate who needs to go on emotion and momentum. And as it turns out, the institutional candidate, John Kerry, is the one with momentum.
We have an email here about General Clark. Why don't we hear of General Clark as a possible vice presidential candidate anymore? Wouldn't an all-Southern Edwards-Clark ticket be more of a threat than an all-Senate Kerry-Edwards ticket, keeping in mind that Clark could deliver Arkansas?
Well, if we hadn't heard it, let's hear it now. I will now say Wesley Clark is a potential vice presidential running mate. I think he actually is. Look, as John Edwards performs well, it enhances his prospects for being on a ticket with John Kerry. If indeed John Kerry becomes the nominee, then John Edwards is a nice fit. You have some geography. But I think there are other people in the mix. I would hope that Dick Gephardt would at least get some consideration coming from the Midwest. Strong ties to organized labor. I would hope that Clark would get some consideration from his military background. Bill Richardson might be getting some consideration. But Wesley Clark, you know, hasn't quite hit his stride on the campaign trail. And he is still two things. He's still a relatively new candidate, and new candidates make mistakes. And second of all, I think there are some people who may wonder whether Wesley Clark has the temperament to be a running mate. A running mate has to say, look, take the attention off me,
right.
Focus on the top of the ticket. I'm not sure whether Clark has demonstrated an ability to sit back and be the guy in the back seat without being the back seat driver.
We're talking about the Democratic race for the president, and the number is 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to send us an email, send it to totn@npr.org. Let's take a call from David in Charlottesville.
Hi.
Hi, David.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I kind of don't like to be sort of told who to vote for, and I'm feeling a little bit kind of pressured about this, you must go for Kerry thing, and I'm just not going to do it. I'm actually very impressed with Wesley Clark, and I think he might be good for the front seat. So I say everybody should go to Clark04.com, take a look at what his policies are, what he wants to do. I think he'll be very impressed, and I think the people of Virginia and Tennessee and Michigan will be very impressed.
Great. With him. All right. Thanks so much for your endorsement.
Thank you.
I think we got a sneak call in there from the Clark campaign. Let's talk about Joe Lieberman. How much influence did he have on this race after all?
None. And the reason is that he is a basically a pro-war candidate and an anti-war party. Lieberman was very, he started out the race. So that's what's so silly about national polls months in advance of a vote. First of all, there is no national primary, but early on, once upon a time, Joe Lieberman was the leading Democratic candidate, and of course, because having been the vice presidential nominee in 2000, that's why he had those numbers. But again, supporting a war in a party where the war was unpopular, and supporting certain faith-valued positions that seemed to be at odds with many Democratic voters. Lieberman was basically in the wrong party at the wrong time.
I would agree. Let me just simply add that in an election cycle where the Democrats are looking for confrontation with the president and seem angry, Joe Lieberman just isn't that kind of person. I mean, there's actually something endearing about him because he isn't that kind of person, but he just was the wrong candidate in the wrong cycle.
He seemed to be running a general election campaign in a time when you have to win primary elections first, and he didn't have that primary election message.
All right, let's hear. I'd like to talk now about some of the other also-rans. Al Sharpton came in third in South Carolina. Let's hear what he had to say last night.
Tonight, we started a movement that will transform the Democratic Party. And I'm going to tell you why. We came to South Carolina with no money, no paid staff, no TV ads, preached in about 25, 26 churches. They brought every official they could in, put them on television commercials. And not only did we come in three in double digits, what no one thought we would do, we doubled Howard Dean, tripled Joe Lieberman. I think that this has been an astounding boost in the arm for the Sharpton campaign.
What he didn't mention is that he came in third among black voters in South Carolina, and that's pretty significant, isn't it?
One out of five black voters backed Al Sharpton yesterday in South Carolina. And South Carolina was always thought to be, according to the Sharpton people, that was going to be his breakthrough state. 45% to 50% of the Democratic electorate there was African American, and Sharpton was hoping to replicate what Jesse Jackson did in 84 and 88. But Jackson ran well not only among black voters, but among white voters. We talked about the Rainbow Coalition. Sharpton was unable to duplicate that Rainbow Coalition in 2004.
And what does that say about where the black vote may be heading this year, or the way black voters may be thinking this year? Again, also looking for someone who can beat George Bush.
Black voters are like white voters, who are like Latino voters. They care about jobs. They care about health care. They're concerned about their kids' future. They're concerned about education. They don't seem to be stereotyped. I mean, just because you had a black candidate running doesn't mean that black voters would naturally gravitate to him.
And I think that Al Sharpton had hoped that perhaps he would get to a point where he could at least play a significant role at the Democratic convention. What chance does he have of that now, Stu?
Not much. He certainly has been talking about collecting delegates along the way so he could play a role in Boston. I must, with all due respect, that cut was an interesting one because it was so out of touch with reality. Early on, I can remember the handicapping community, like us or not like us, but early on we were talking about, can Al Sharpton win South Carolina? How well will he do? Can he rival Jesse Jackson? The idea that a third place finish at 10% somehow exceeded expectation is just strange. I believe he got one delegate yesterday, and I don't even think it was in South Carolina. I think it may have been in Delaware. Is that right, Ken?
Yes.
So I think that the problem is where Jesse Jackson was, as Ken points out, was able to get beyond race and try to run a more credible, a class-based campaign. I think Al Sharpton just became the black candidate, and I think a lot of African American voters looked at him and said, "No, we want to participate in the choice of a Democratic nominee."
And just one more, Dennis Kucinich, barely registered, but he's staying in the race.
As he should. Dennis Kucinich stands for something that no other candidates do. He may not have the popular support in the party, but he is for an immediate pullout in Iraq. He's for total withdrawal of things like the WTO and NAFTA and things like that. So he may not have a significant popular appeal in the party, but he stands for something that the other candidates, he talks about things that the other candidates don't talk about. And he's not running to win the nomination, although he says he is. He's running to be a certain conscience of the party, and that's why he's staying in.
We're going to take a break, save that thought.
Uh-huh.
We're talking about the results from yesterday's primary and caucus races and what they mean for the Democratic candidates. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK or send us an email at totn@npr.org. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary. We're talking today about the Democratic race for the presidency. My guests are Stuart Rothenberg, a political analyst and editor of the Rothenberg Political Report, and Ken Rudin, who is NPR's own political editor. We're going to take some calls now. If you'd like to join the discussion, the number 1-800-989-8255. That's 1-800-989-TALK. And let's take a call now from George, and I believe that George is in Greenville, North Carolina. Is that right, George?
That's correct.
Okay, go ahead.
I just want to let you know the buzzword around here is we're very proud of John Edwards, and we're proud of what he's doing and the great leaps that he's made from basically nobody knowing who he was to being right behind John Kerry. But the buzzword is a Kerry-Edwards ticket. And I was listening to another NPR call-in show this morning, and a gentleman from Rock Hill, South Carolina called in, and the commentators didn't pick up on what he was really saying. But his point was that, you know, we're not selling John Edwards short. We'd love to see him, you know, become president. But with all this recent attention he's getting, we're really getting fired up that hopefully this will raise the national consciousness of who he is. And the Kerry folks will pay some real serious attention to him. And he is a great representative of the South, the working class. Kerry's got the North. He's got the veteran vote. What a perfect ticket. So what we're kind of essentially doing is, you know, trying to vote this guy into maybe even the vice president position, which to me is a weird phenomena. But, you know, we're so focused on getting the Bush administration out of the White House that this could be just, you know, the perfect, perfect ticket. And we're really rooting for John.
All right. I'd like to hear our analysts' reaction to that thought. Thanks so much for calling in,
sure.
George. It does sound like a pretty good ticket, North-South. Kerry has the vote on national security, the war background. Edwards is supposed to be the compassion candidate. What do you think, Ken?
Well, I mean, we've seen North-South before. We've seen Kennedy and Johnson in 1960, which was a great ticket. We've also seen Dukakis and Benson in 1988, which was not such a good ticket. The point is that Democrats historically, when the Democrats win, if you look at the last three Democratic presidents, Lyndon Johnson, Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, they all came from the South. You can make the argument that you have to have a Southern presence on the ticket to win. But then you could also look at Al Gore in 2000. He won no Southern state, including Florida, if you think that he did not win Florida. And yet he got more votes than George W. Bush. And in fact, had he won any of the other small states, he could have won the presidency. So while the South is very crucial, it seems at this point to be George W. Bush country, and many Democrats are not convinced that you have to have a Southern on the ticket to win this time.
Yeah. Oh, we have an email here asking that question. It seems like the Southern strategy is now simply assumed to be a fundamental requirement for a successful run for the presidency in the event of a Kerry nomination. What are the chances of Kerry, a New Englander, abandoning the South and concentrating instead on Ohio, Michigan, and the upper Midwest, Stu?
Well, I don't think that John Kerry would ever announce that he's abandoning the South. I think that candidates want to demonstrate that they have national appeal, and if they're elected, they're going to represent the whole country. They're going to have to govern the whole country, so he's going to run nationally. But I don't think that's a bad scenario at all. I mean, I think John Kerry, if you ask me, I think he would have a better chance of turning Ohio than a couple of these southern states other than Florida. Florida is half southern and half northern. But otherwise, you know, what chances do the Democrats have? Arkansas, maybe Louisiana, possibly if you put John Edwards on the ticket, the Democrats might look at North Carolina. That would be a long shot. So I like the email suggestion. It seems to me that the Ohio scenario was a much better one for the Democrats.
Let me ask you about this Kerry Edwards ticket, which people seem to be starting to put them together as a ticket. What does that mean for them campaigning? I mean, they must perhaps have that already in their heads, or they're already talking about that. Does that mean they can't play too hardball with each other in the event that they're eventually going to be on a ticket together?
Well, the problem with John Edwards playing hardball is that his whole candidacy has been predicated on the fact that he's the good guy. Now, of course, it was easy to be the good guy when the opponent was Howard Dean. I mean, Howard Dean was kind of like had tendency to be nasty early in the debates cycle, so John Edwards would appear as the undean, the nice guy. But when you run against John Kerry, who's also a nice guy, you have to point out, for John Edwards to get anywhere, he's going to have to point out differences between himself and John Kerry, and you can't do that by just being a nice guy.
We're going to talk about money now. Millions of dollars have been spent so far by the candidates in pursuit of the nomination, and only the residents of 9 states have had a chance to vote so far. We can expect a lot more fundraising and a lot more money spent on TV ads in the weeks ahead. But where is the money going to come from, and how hard is it going to be for candidates like Wesley Clark and Howard Dean to raise more funds? With us to talk about money and politics is Anthony Corrado. He's a professor of government at Colby College in Waterville, Maine, and is spending this year as a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution here in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for inviting me, Lynn.
Do we know exactly how much money has been spent so far by the candidates?
Well, so far, the Democrats have raised about $170 million in private donations and public funding altogether, and all of that money has now been spent. This very competitive contest has proved to be very expensive, so that as we enter this crucial part of the nominating process, no candidate really has a large reservoir of cash that's available to be spent.
Yeah, both Dean and Kerry used the same strategy, focusing on Iowa and New Hampshire, but came up with very different results, didn't they?
Yes, they did, and it was particularly problematic for Howard Dean, because what Dean decided to do was use the large store of cash that he had raised in 2003 to spend lots of money in the states that would be voting in February, as well as in Iowa and New Hampshire. And as a result, spent over $3.5 million on television in states that were voting after New Hampshire, whereas John Kerry basically took all of the money he had and put it into Iowa and New Hampshire and was able to get the victories he needed to spur additional fundraising so that he right now is in the best position, even though he ended up raising much less than Howard Dean prior to New Hampshire. He's now in the best position to raise and spend money in this next stage of the race.
Yeah, and what about Dean? Has he been able to, he was so well known for his fundraising. How has his fundraising been since he has started losing?
Well, his fundraising has actually held up very well. He's raising about $1 million a week. He's raised about $3 million since that now infamous night in Iowa. But one of the problems that he has is that he built such a large organization that it is very expensive to maintain. And as a result, he has not had money for television advertising this week. He's not doing any television advertising in the states this weekend, and he probably won't do any television advertising in Tennessee and Virginia. So he's basically gone off of the airwaves in terms of paid television, with the exception of looking towards Wisconsin, which isn't until February 17th.
How difficult it's going to be for all of these candidates to raise money at this point, other than, say, Kerry, who seems to be, you know, gaining the momentum in the results and probably then also in fundraising as well?
Well, it's very difficult. We're at the point now in the presidential campaign where success breeds success. And if you win and if you show a little momentum, you'll raise a little more money. If you fail to do that, then your fundraising dries up pretty quickly. And as we've seen both with Clark and Edwards, the effects of that. Edwards has done fairly well raising money since he did so well in Iowa and New Hampshire. And he has right now about $1 million available to spend in Tennessee and Virginia, so he'll be able to do campaigning there. But he's basically operating out of his wallet. They look in the campaign each morning at how much money they have in the bank and decide how they can most effectively spend it. And that's the way it's going to be for some time. Wes Clark benefited from that surge he had in New Hampshire during January, where he was very successful raising some money as he was climbing in the polls. And the benefit was that he earned almost $1.5 million in public matching funds from the government that were paid to him on February 1st. And that provided him with a little additional fuel that got him through yesterday. But once again, he's now looking at a campaign that's pretty straight in terms of its money. In fact, he'll probably only be able to do television in Tennessee this week. So he really needs something to happen if he wants to keep the money coming in.
Of course, all the remaining candidates are still vowing to stay until the bitter end, but at some point there's got to be a financial reality check that factors into a decision to remain in the race or to drop out.
That's exactly right. I mean, it costs money just to keep the campaign operating, to keep the staff paid, to keep the airplane in the air. And so as a result, you eventually reach the point where if you're not winning, you're not raising the type of money you need just to continue campaigning. And that's usually what leads a candidate to decide to drop out.
One other question before you go, and this is something that all three of you can comment on if you like. Explain to us the role of delegates and superdelegates in these races exactly.
Well, I guess I'll begin. I think right now they become very important because, in a way, the superdelegates are their own primary. And we still have over 540 of these party leader and elected officials who haven't committed to a candidate. And they usually tend to wait to see who's going to be the front runner, and they also wait to see who would look best at the top of the ticket. So that as a result, they tend to be delegates who can move quickly, particularly as a front runner emerges. And we've seen that in the last week with a number of these superdelegates getting on board with John Kerry. I expect we'll see more of it this week. And for the other candidates, they're going to have to start showing that they can be as strong in the general election if they hope to compete in that primary.
All right. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you again.
Anthony Corrado is a professor of government at Colby College and a visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke to us from his office here in Washington. What about it, Ken? Maybe I'd like to hear you comment a little on the superdelegate, the importance of the superdelegate and delegates.
Well, you know, what's fascinating about the superdelegates are the people, they are automatically delegates to the convention. They are, their decision is not bound by their state primary or caucuses. And usually the role of the superdelegates historically has been to give this weighty matter, decide late in the process who would be the strongest candidate, and then decide. What's very interesting is this year is that so many superdelegates, Al Gore is the one who comes to mind the most, Tom Harkin in Iowa, they jumped on the Howard Dean bandwagon when it looked like Howard Dean was the front runner. And that's so remarkable because usually these are not supposed to be impetuous decisions. You're supposed to just, you know, reflect and then decide. And a lot of these superdelegates jumped on early. That's why Howard Dean has as many delegates as he has today, not because he's done so well in the 9 contests so far, but because of these superdelegates.
All right, we have an email now. Historically, who were some of the other candidates who ran, like Kucinich and Sharpton now, primarily to get some important message across? And have any of them ever really surprised us? Stu?
Oh, well, that's a tough one. When you think back, I mean, on the Republican, let's take a candidate on the Republican side. Somebody like Alan Keyes or Gary Bauer were running. I don't think they ever had any real chance of winning the Republican presidential nomination. But Alan Keyes, in addition to it being kind of a form of his day job, was on a mission. He was he wanted to get the agenda out there of social issues, religious issues, and being out and being able to talk to people to get his message out was what it was about. Now, I think there's a little difference with Dennis Kucinich. Frankly, I can finally get my point back in. I think Dennis Kucinich is actually running for something. He is running for the leader of the progressive movement in this country, the kind of position that Ralph Nader has held for a while. I don't mean liberal when I say progressive. I mean community-based mm-hmm. progressive movement. And I think that's what he is trying to do. Now, Alan Keyes was not didn't have that elaborate a goal in mind. But there have been candidates almost every cycle who really have no chance but are out there to talk about an issue.
And even the candidates who've gotten far more support than the Sharptons and the Kuciniches, Pat Buchanan on the Republican side, Jesse Jackson on the Democratic side, they were clearly not going to be their party's nominee when they ran, but they had a message to bring and they wanted to hear it. They wanted the convention to hear it.
Yeah. We're talking about the Democratic race for president. If you'd like to join the discussion, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Brian in St. Louis. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. I voted in the primary in Springfield, Missouri, and it was a vote for Edwards. I thought he had the best message, and he really, really was the person that I wanted to go to. If Kerry gets the nomination overall, though, I will vote for Kerry because I just need to get Baby Bush out of the office.
Well, that sounds like a typical Democratic voter.
Yeah, well, it's just what I don't know. I didn't vote in the last election. I really felt bad about that. I lived in Oklahoma at the time, and I thought Gore was going to win, and I didn't think my vote was going to be needed. But I really want Bush out of there. I think he's bad for the country. I think he's bad for the economy, bad for jobs.
All right. Well, thanks for your call, Brian.
Well, thank you.
And let me remind listeners that you are listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take another call now from Bill, and he is in Pennsylvania. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead.
I don't know if there are any other debates scheduled, but my question is, if there are, at what point does the field for the debates get narrowed? When do they sort of say, Dennis Kucinich or Al Sharpton, you don't get to come anymore? I think it reduces the value of the debates when Peter Jennings has to spend as much time questioning Al Sharpton or Dennis Kucinich and as anyone else, and reduces the ability for some dialogue between the viable candidates.
Is there a point where they can say you can't come to the debates anymore, Stu?
Sure, I think there are debates still scheduled in Wisconsin, California before the March contests. I would, this is a controversial question. It's a controversial point, and no matter what I say, somebody's going to disagree violently. I think we've reached that point. I think the voters have had an opportunity. Now we're talking about in 9 states, either caucuses or primaries, to evaluate these candidates, and a couple of them are showing up, getting a couple percentage of points. I think the media have an obligation to give them a platform initially to see if they sell. But at some point, I agree with the caller. I think if you're getting 2 or 3 percentage points, you're really not in the mix anymore.
They do have the criteria in the fall during the general election debates. Third-party candidates will be invited to the debates only if they meet a certain threshold. Maybe it's 15% of the vote, but they don't have that now with the primary candidates.
Yeah, and you both have said already, I think, that we don't see any third-party candidates coming along. We don't see the possibility of we have another email here suggesting the possibility of Dean running as an independent candidate, but neither of you see that.
Well, Ralph Nader continues to mull the possibility that he may run as an independent or a third-party candidate. I don't know what the Greens are going to be doing, but I don't think Howard Dean. I think Howard Dean has made it clear that he is going to be returned to the fold once he is out of this race, if he is out of this race. I don't see a major third-party candidate in 2004.
When is it clear who's going to be the candidate? I mean, is there a point that you could say that everybody else falls away and it's clear that it's John Kerry? What is he? How many of these races does he have to win? What are the key states he has to run for it to be certain?
Well, by March 9th, Super Tuesday is March 2nd when New York, California, Ohio vote, and other states. March 9th includes the states of Florida and Texas. By March 9th, over 70% of the delegates at stake will have been chosen. And again, as winning begets winning, if John Kerry goes on and on, one would suspect that will not change. And by March 9th, at the minimum, that he can declare, victory. I think that's happened in the past when most of the majority of the delegates were chosen.
Yeah, and in the end, what will Dean looks now? We're seeing don't write the political obituary yet, but looks like he's not doing too well. Probably won't get the nomination. What did he do for this campaign? What has his campaign done for the entire Democratic race?
Well, I think he's done a lot in the fact that he's brought thousands, if not tens of thousands of people to this process who were never involved before. Now, many may be in states that were not involved yet, like the Pennsylvania votes late, Indiana votes late, too late to matter for the Democratic nominee, but he's brought a lot of new people into the process.
Well, thanks for being with us, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin and political analyst Stuart Rothenberg. It's Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary.